Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Gregory Melville and Susan Fox and Kathleen Bromage.
What are we doing tonight?
Tonight? We make soap.
Really?
To make soap, first we render fat.
The salt balance has to be just right, so the best fat for making soap comes from humans.
Wait, what is this place?
A liposuction clinic. Aha, pay dirt. Richest, creamiest fat in the world. Fat of the land.
As the fat renders, the talus float to the surface, like in Boy Scouts.
Hard to imagine you as a Boy Scout.
Keep stirring. Once the tallow hardens, you skim off a layer of glycerin. If you were to add nitric acid, you got nitroglycerin. If you were then to add sodium nitrile, a dash of sawdust, you got dynamite. Yeah, with enough soap, one could blow up just about anything.
Tyler was full of useful information.
Now, ancient peoples found their clothes got cleaner when they washed them at a certain point in the river. Do you know why?
No.
Human sacrifices were once made on the hills above this river. Bodies burned, water seeped through the wood and ashes to create lye. This is lye, the crucial ingredient. Once it mixed with the melted fat of the bodies, a thick white soapy discharge crept into the river.
Tyler sold this soap to department stores at $20 a bar. God knows what they charged.
This is the best soap.
Why, thank you, Susan.
It was beautiful. We were selling rich women their own fat asses back to them.
All right. That is from Fight Club. It might be the greatest soap scene in the history of cinema. Or at least it is until somebody tells me different. We are going to be talking about soap today on the show. Why are we doing that? Well, that should be obvious at this point, although maybe not entirely clear to you. But obviously, we are living in the era of hand washing and extra cautious hygiene. But often what you hear about, what people fight over, are Purell and other hand sanitizers. And there's kind of a sense that there's this hierarchy of cleaners and that soap is not sitting on top of it. Soap is like the thing you use as a last resort. And it turns out exactly the opposite is the case. You could make a pretty persuasive argument that when it comes to fighting the coronavirus, there's nothing better than soap. There's nothing it hates worse than soap. It sees soap coming, and in its little nanoparticle face, it starts frowning and swearing or doing whatever viruses do when they're not happy and when they're really worried. And here to tell you more about this, I should say later in the show, some of us, particularly in college, wound up buying this very peculiar kind of soap called Dr. Bronner's. We're going to tell you all about Dr. Bronner's. We're going to tell you all kinds of other randomized facts about soap that you don't know. But right now, to give us the big picture, Brian Resnick is a senior science reporter for Vox. Boy, Vox has just turned out to be so indispensable during this particular period. Whenever you want to know stuff, Vox is really great. And he's joining us by Skype, which is not at all an annoying or difficult to use piece of technology. And he's with us now. Hi, Brian.
Hey, I love Dr. Bronner's. I use the eucalyptus scents. So,
and then you have to sort of, you can spend the whole day just trying to read the stuff on the label. Like, what's going on?
I know.
What are they trying to tell me? Well, we will actually unravel all of that in another segment that you won't be on, but maybe you'll listen to it.
I'll listen to it for sure.
We're recording this on Wednesday. And so I sort of stole your punchline at the beginning, but I'll let you deliver it again. Yes, everybody is having, you know, fistfights in Costco aisles. Who can get this hand sanitizer? Who can get the antibacterial soap? Who can get all this fancy stuff? When what they should be doing is just slipping about four or five bars of pretty much any kind of regular old soap into their carts. Tell us why.
Yeah. Well, I will make clear at the top here that hand sanitizer works. It definitely is effective, and it does kill the coronavirus. But the CDC recommends that you should start with soap and water. And when you can't get to soap and water, then that's where sanitizer comes into play. So I don't want anyone to get the picture that, oh no, now the sanitizer is no good. It is good. It works, but it just doesn't work as, there are some conditions under which it would not work as well, but soap, it works every time. So, you know, if you have soap, and any type of soap, really, it doesn't have, like, antibacterial soap, actually, the FDA does not advise anyone buy, because the evidence that it does anything extra than just having soap is not there, and it actually might enhance antibiotic resistance. Another problem, another thing to discuss at another time, some other crisis in the future. But yeah, just any soap is we should be really thankful for this, like, really ancient kind of piece of chemistry.
Right. So we need to talk a little bit about that piece of chemistry, and in a way that even Ed Norton and Brad Pitt might not understand. So there's a lot of things going on down there at the nano level. I don't know if you can put this into layman's terms, although I note that the term crowbar seems very useful.
So, you know, there are a lot of different types of soap, a lot of chemical formulations. I'll ensure your listeners, like, the soap you buy does not come from human flesh at all. But no matter what it is or the exact formula of the soap, they're all... the chemists call the molecules that they're called amplophiles. So all soaps are amplophiles. And basically that means they are a molecule that has two ends, and one end is really attracted to water and the other end is attracted to fat. So you have this molecule and it has this kind of dual nature to it. And, you know, I think, like, the clearest depiction I can give you of, like, why soap works is, so imagine having, like, a glass of water, and you pour some oil into it, and you see that the oil pools at the top. You know, the oil and water does not mix. But then if you add some soap into that mixture of oil and water and shake it up, the oil disperses. It kind of breaks apart. And what's happening there is that the fat-loving side of these amplophile molecules, the soap molecules, kind of attach themselves to the oil, and the water-loving side kind of pull them into the water. So you basically kind of get this demolition crew of soap, kind of acts as, like, this demolition crew, kind of like pulling oily, greasy things apart from one another. The soaps then, like, surrounds each particle of oil and kind of just pushes them away from one another, and then, you know, they disperse, and then you've gotten rid of your grease. And, you know, everyone knows this. Like, if you're washing dishes with just water, you add some soap, you know, the greasy bits slide off a little bit better.
Yeah, I mean, and it is helpful to think of the fact that a virus is, it really is a nanoparticle. It's this tiny little thing, and it's not made of very much either.
No. And luckily for us, it's the outermost layer of the, so the virus is basically two things. It's a bit of genetic information that's surrounded by this kind of fat and protein shell. And what's great when it comes to washing our hands with soap and water, soap, you know, it doesn't matter what the fat is, it's going to do that same thing I just described to you, you know, in the example of having your glass of water with some, like, a puddle of oil in it. You can think of a virus as just, like, this little tiny grease ball, you know, or this grease ball that's, you know, has this genetic information inside of it. And what the soap does is what it does to the grease, like, in anywhere it encounters it, it pulls it apart. So if you get some soap on your hands, you start rubbing your hands, and then those little particles, those little soap particles, will interact with the virus and kind of lodge themselves into the actual, that kind of fatty outer shell of the virus, and pull it apart, pull it into the water. And then when the virus, when it's, like, outer shell, this, like, fatty outer shell is separated from the genetic material inside, that virus is deactivated. It's not, you know, it's not actually alive to begin with, so you can't quite call it killed, but it's basically, it's gone. And, you know, you then wash it down the sink.
So unlike other time impositions that your mother told you about, like, wait an hour before going swimming, there really is something true about this other part of it that I think we haven't mentioned yet, which is you've got to give the soap a chance to do the to be its badass self. The soap needs a little chance to hunt down all those viruses and tear them apart like the creepy little nanopunks that they are. So say a little bit more about that.
Yeah, well, you need to wash your hands for around 20 seconds for a few reasons. One is, like, you actually have a lot of surface area on your hand. You know, your skin is actually a little bit wrinkly. You have a lot of parts to your hand, you know, the fingertips, the back of the hand, the palm. And then, you know, it's also, you know, because it's rough, like, the viruses can, like, live in, like, or they can, you know, cling to, like, the little folds of your skin. So you just need to spend some time, like, working that soap into all the little wrinkles of your skin and, you know, in and around your skin, you know, around your hand. And then, you know, it takes, like, a moment or so. Like, I don't think there's, like, an exact amount of time, but, like, once the soap is interacting with the virus, it does take, like, a moment or so for it to do its thing. But even if it's, like, not destroying the virus, it will, like, remove it from your hand. So the virus, because it has that fatty layer, like, your skin is a little fatty too, and, like, the fat can cling to fat. And basically what the soap can do too, it, like, it'll just, like, you know, clear that virus off of your hands, because it won't let the virus attach itself to your hand any longer. So yes, the soap will deactivate the virus. If it doesn't deactivate all of the virus, like, it's hard to know if it's, you know, I don't have, like, a microscope to look at every, like, hand washing interaction. It will at least flush it down the water, and it'll also flush all sorts of things down the water. Like, there are some bacteria that are a lot tougher than viruses that might not be killed by soap outright, but those will be flushed down the sink. And, you know, yeah, so it's useful.
You know what? I just come up with an idea sitting here that I feel like if you and I can get the venture capital, which I realize isn't exactly flying around right now, but Brian, mm-hmm. I have an idea, and I think we could both become extremely rich, provided that once this thing goes away and there's a new vision coming. But we know there's going to be – this isn't our last pandemic. You ready? Mm-hmm. Sink in a car, all right? Because here's the problem. Like, you got to bring all this other junk in the car. You got to bring Purells and alcohol wipes and all this kind of stuff, because you can't do this really simple thing in your car. At least I can't do it in my car, where I can't wash my hands with soap.
Well,
sink in a car. Brian, think about this.
It's an okay idea, but I would say in those situations in your car, hand sanitizer works just fine. The thing about hand sanitizer is that concentrate, like, alcohol can mimic soap and it can do the same thing, kind of tear the virus apart. But it needs to be in a high concentration. It needs to be at least 60% alcohol. Mm-hmm. So, like, if your hands are a little bit sweaty, or if, like, they're kind of, like, if there's other dirt on them that the virus is clinging to, you know, they might not be as effective in every scenario compared to soap. But yeah, I would agree with your sitting in the car idea, you know, provided that you can keep, like, clean water in your car and you're not.
Well, yeah,
just,
those are things.
Recycling.
I'm still smarting from your saying it's an okay idea. The next time you're at Vox headquarters, you're walking down the hall, you see Ezra coming the other way, just say, sink in a car. See what he does.
I figure it'd be rude to go on your show and say it's a bad idea. But, I you know, it's keep working on it.
All right. No, these ideas, they come to me, and because I have no stick-to-itiveness, then they go out of. That's why I have to tell somebody about them. I'm just kind of hoping that you can take this and run with it. But Kat Pastor says she kind of wants one. So, you know, so we know these things. And one of the things you've been doing a lot of other reporting on for Vox, and I, in all seriousness, Vox has been just terrific, a great place to turn for really good information, is, I mean, we're still struggling a little bit. We're trying to, studying this particular novel coronavirus and this pandemic, it's like trying to do an artist's sketch of a train that's racing by you, right? It's a moving thing. It's a new thing. We're trying to learn about it by watching it behave for the first time. These are just a set of behaviors, you know, over 3 months' time or so that we can observe. So in terms of, like, how we clean stuff, how we keep our environment safe, all that kind of stuff, we're still learning about that, right? I mean, we know certain things about how long it'll last on certain surfaces, and it likes certain kinds of surfaces better than others. But I sense that there's still some stuff we don't know.
Yeah, I think that's a huge thing to keep in mind here. So I think the World Health Organization first set out its alert of a pneumonia circulating in China with an unknown origin, and it was, like, right after New Year's. It was the first week of January, and so, like, this was not known to science before January. So, you know, there's just a lot of things about it that we're just going to have to wait and see. Like, people are asking about, can you get reinfected by this virus? And, you know, the answer to that is probably not, based on, like, what virologists know about how this family of viruses work. But, you know, we need to do the tests and see, like, months down the line after people recover, we need to test their blood to see if they still are provoking an immune response to it. So there's just some things that, you know, understandably everyone wants answers. And we have learned a ton about this virus. You know, one of the first things scientists did was to sequence its genetics. And that now leads to, we now have vaccines that are being tested, even though, you know, the testing process is very slow. We at least have the formulas to get started on seeing if there's a safe and effective vaccine. You know, just understanding the virus at the molecular level also helps us understand, like, which drugs might be, which might work against it. And those drug trials have started too. So, you know, it's unfortunately, there's just some things we're just going to have to be patient about too.
Right. I mean, and there are questions that are still kind of open. And I've talked to a bunch of epidemiologists about this as well. And you don't always get exactly the same answer. For example, how aerosolized it is or isn't. Yeah. In other words, if you're stepping into an environment where something could have put it in the air, how long is that air dangerous? I'm not sure we really know that yet.
No, that's being worked out. Like, it's not like the measles that could really linger in the air for hours in this aerosolized form. And measles is the most contagious, or one of the most contagious diseases, viruses known to mankind. So it's not like that. We know that. But it does spread via droplets from the nose and mouth. And yes, you're right. Researchers are still trying to figure out what conditions under which, like, the virus can linger in the air for a little bit. You know, it's probably not going to linger in the air for hours based on what we know and how it spreads. But yes, you're right. Just like understanding and what scenarios that the virus could linger in the air, you know, that would be important for hospitals to know so they can make sure, you know, if a room gets cleared out, that, you know, it's safe for others to enter and so on and so forth.
All right. Well, one thing that we do know, though, is soap. Soap and water.
Soap works.
For 20
soap
seconds.
Soap is dope.
Soap is dope. All right. So that's an excellent slogan. See, I didn't call that an okay slogan. I said an excellent slogan. By Brian Resnick, who's a senior science reporter for Vox. He joined us by the incredible communications miracle that is Skype. And we thank you very much for your time today, Brian.
Thank you.
All right. Let's take a little break here. We're going to come back with the ever popular more. We will tell you about Dr. Bronner's extremely weird soap and many other things about soap that will delight and please you and make you the life of cocktail parties when they start having those again, which might be quite some time, actually. Anyway, we'll be back. A little bit of soap will wash away your lipstick from my face. A little bit of soap will never, 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 ever erase the pain in my heart, in my eyes, as I go through the lonely years. A little bit of soap will never wash away my tears. Ooh, a little bit of soap, a little bit of soap will take away your powder from my chin. Okay, now it's Wednesday. We recorded that on Tuesday. I don't know why you would care about that, but it's now live on Wednesday if you happen to be listening live on Wednesday. So when we first started talking about doing a show on soap, and we now have meetings by Zoom, when Jonathan McNichol first mentioned producing this show, Betsy Kaplan, senior producer, and I both said, well, we have to do a segment on the, you know, the doctor. And then we each said a different name that was not Bronner because we didn't remember it correctly. And Jonathan looked at us blankly. And then we said, you know, with the label, with the crazy talk on it. And he still didn't know what we were talking about. And 2 days later, he wanted information emailed. Oh, no, I just did the days wrong. Okay, it's Thursday today, and we recorded the other thing on a Wednesday. You can see how things get, though, when you're doing shows from home and you start trying to get real specific about days, which I'm not even sure we do days anymore. So anyway, Dr. Bronner's is a thing. It's a kind of soap, and it has a peculiar cachet. And I think the fact, although actually what we should do is just ask Kieran Dahl about this. Kieran Dahl's a freelance writer. His piece for Vox, it is like so Vox Day here on our show. How a decades-old hippie soap brand became a touchstone of wellness culture. He is joining us also through the technical marvel that is Skype. Kieran, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So, you know, as I recount that conversation to you, a key detail is that Betsy Kaplan and I, who immediately our thoughts went to Dr. Bronner, even though we couldn't remember the name accurately, we are a little bit older than producer Jonathan McNichol. And there's a way in which some of the imprinting on Dr. Bronner, I think, was done by kind of baby boomers in college. Does that make sense?
Yeah. As far as I can tell, it seems like Dr. Bronner's became popular initially in kind of the counterculture of the 60s and 70s, you know, when hippies and other long-haired people valued products that didn't harm the environment and had sort of an equitable supply chain. And so that was kind of the first big boom in Dr. Bronner's business. And now, you know, 50 years later, as conscious consumerism becomes this increasingly popular trend, people are getting back into Dr. Bronner's because it basically just stands for all the values that people want in their products, you know, that are not harmful and, in fact, in some cases, even bettering the environment and the world.
Right. So, and we'll sort of get to that in a second. I will add my own completely unsubstantiated theory, which is that in the 60s and 70s, all male dorms in college were pretty common. And all male dorms in college and the bathrooms associated with them always smelled pretty terrible. And Dr. Bronner's peppermint soap in particular was something, a product that you could use, and it would so completely saturate the air with the aroma of its peppermint oil or whatever's doing that, that it did cover a multitude of sins, and a multitude of sins were often being committed. So it may have something to do with that. But so in your article, I think one of the things that you say is that Dr. Bronner's is kind of the anti-product. It's kind of the anti-consumer product. It's for much of its own history, according to one of the current generations of Bronner's. It had no salespeople, no advertising, and was run by a man with no eyesight, with a label that violated every tenet of label design. So that's quite a sort of brainful right there. But there's a way in which, right, it just didn't do any of the things that mass consumer products typically do.
Yeah, so I think, first of all, from the beginning, the company has not focused on profits, but on activism. They call themselves a for-profit company with non-profit roots. And I think that you really see that in how they present themselves and moreover, where they put their money. They really, you know, their revenue last year was around $130 million, and they gave millions of that to various charitable causes. And they're very public about their activism. And, you know, their current CEO, David Bronner, a grandson of the founder, Emmanuel Bronner, he has been arrested for his activism, for planting hemp seeds on the lawn of the DEA. And so just from the top to the bottom of the company, there's very little in the way of sort of modern corporate practices that you would see in other, even organic brands, and especially in other personal care brands.
Right. I mean, in terms of some of their causes, I mean, they care about the planet, but it's also, I think, a world in which marijuana and maybe some other things, too, are legal, and people are microdosing in a way that makes them even more harmonious with the planet is somewhere in a way that probably wouldn't necessarily conform with the original thinking of Emmanuel Bronner, whom we should also say, as far as I know, was not a doctor of any kind.
No, he was definitely not a doctor, and he wasn't even a businessman. He was just a guy with this sort of moral credo that he wanted to proselytize across the world, and that came from his own trauma-filled background. You know, his parents were killed in the Holocaust, and he immigrated to the U.S. when he was young, and basically just started going around the country promoting peace and you know, general welfare and sort of love between people. And, you know, especially right now, I think his message has really never been more pertinent.
Although I think it's fair to say Okay, I'm holding a 32-ounce bottle of the peppermint soap right here, and there's this 3,000-word wall of text, as you say, and it's in very tiny type. But even if you enlarge it in various ways and study it pretty carefully, I mean, my sense is that although you can make out the vague outlines of a philosophy to which you have just alluded, you could really read this stuff for a long time and not really divine the consciousness of Immanuel Bronner. And not, I mean, Bronnerism could not be practiced the way other philosophies can be. I would say, anyway, there's just like too much weirdness going on.
No, definitely. I mean, if you just looking at the label, it is this, just a wall of text that is filled with non sequiturs and poor punctuation and references to everyone from Jesus and Einstein and Muhammad to Mao and Stalin and Hitler and dinosaurs and slavery and multi-level marketing even. And so I think if you sort of go by just the label, there doesn't seem to be any sort of coherence. But it's sort of the broad themes of the label and by association, the company itself that, you know, through those things, you begin to see how there's just this ethos of goodwill and caring for other people that, you know, I think it's definitely clearer now than just the label by itself is.
Yes. The label is as though Ben Franklin washed down a lot of Molly with Red Bull or something, you know, I mean,
yeah.
It has a kind of manic quality to it. And so just to give people a sense, and this, we could pick anything, but each day, like a bird, perfect thyself first to have courage and smile, my friend, think and act 10 years ahead. And the man without fault, he's dead. Do one thing at a time, work hard, get done, then teach friend and enemy how to work and how to love, for God is love, uniting all one above in God's eternal all one God faith. So, and I remember being in college in the 70s and, you know, having this product, and people sort of talked about it. I think people thought that this might be some kind of right-wing nut or something, that we, you know, we just liked the soap, but it was like Coors beer or something. The more you knew about the people who put it out, the less happy you were with your consumer choice. But it isn't that at all. I mean, he really seems to have been quite serious about this notion of peace and peace by eccentric but genuine means. I mean, he seems like he probably was a pretty good guy in kind of a nutty way.
Yeah, I think that even though he didn't have the necessary qualifications to call himself a doctor, he, you know, the things he proselytized were you know, values that today, you know, we recognize as being positive. And I think there's just been kind of this authenticity to the brand that really has lasted from 1948 when the company was founded to now. And, you know, the fact that the company is run by Emmanuel's grandsons now, and many other members of the Bronner clan are a part of the company, just shows that there's sort of been this consistency of branding and of the message that you really don't see in anymore with so many brands, you know, trying to concoct these brand stories of altruism and authenticity. But Dr. Bronner's is really one of the only brands I can think of that's been practicing what it's been preaching for, you know, some 75 years.
Right. So we should hear a little bit of the man himself. I didn't realize it was possible to do that. He died in 1997. He was 89 years old at that time. In 2017, the company released an album of recordings that he'd made of himself called Sisters and Brothers. This is a little bit of the first track. It's a little bit of an edit, The Moral ABC, first through fourth. Here we go.
First, if I'm not for me, who am I? Nobody. Second, if I'm only for me, what am I? Nothing. Third, if not now, when? Fourth, only hard work can save us. But if we teach only our clan, we're all hated then. So we must teach friend and enemy the hard work, speech, press, and profit-sharing moral ABC. Hillel taught Jesus to lightning-like unite all mankind free in our eternal Father's great, all one God faith, for we are all one or none.
All right, there's the man himself. So one thing that's worth noting here, and I was going to note it in the third segment, but it sort of fits right here. The vast preponderance of what is bought these days in America as sold as soap is actually detergent. Soap actually has a very specific set of FDA requirements, and very few things fit it. But Kieran, this thing, you know, I mean, says right on the label, pure Castile soap, and then you list the ingredients, and these are all recognizable words from nature that, you know, Michael Pollan would approve of. These are all, you know, these aren't weird chemicals and stuff like that. And that's kind of an amazing thing that they could stay with that for that long.
Yeah, I think so too. And, you know, it was only recently that their ingredient list even changed at all. A few years ago, David Bronner was instrumental in having hemp oil for a smoother lather added to the list of ingredients. And I think that some people went sort of up in arms at that, because that was really the only thing that had changed about the soap in however many years. But it really seems like the company is just still being molded, you know, as if by the ghost of Emmanuel Bronner. And it's just kind of amazing to see how their entire brand identity just kind of coalesces around these solitary set of ideas. It's just a really fascinating company.
I mean, one thing that I can say from personal experience is in the 60s and 70s, there started to spring up around America health food stores. You know, this was before Whole Foods wiped most of them out. These little independent health food stores, and would have bare wood on the floors and stuff like that. And there would be a lot of products that had essentially been invented and introduced to please hippies. And these were products, for the most part, these were companies that probably hadn't existed for very long and probably wouldn't exist for very long. And the anomaly among them, in a way, was Dr. Bronner's, which had already existed for a really long time, but fulfilled all of the requirements that hippies had for naturalness and was going to continue existing long after anybody was using the term hippies to describe themselves or other people immediately on the scene. And that's kind of one of the weird things. It's kind of been so unhip. It's had a whole series of opportunities to kind of re-up its hipness. And so that's happening now, Kieran, and maybe you can sort of just describe the way A-listers are just flocking towards this product.
Yeah, sure. So, as you said, the company has just, it's sort of prided itself on its antiquated unhipness, you know, how its label hasn't changed, its ingredients haven't changed. But now I think with these sort of twin trends of holistic personal wellness and conscious consumerism, there's the profile of Dr. Bronner's has been lifted by this influx of people who want to consume and buy products that are good for them, are good for the environment, and don't make them feel guilty about buying them. And of course, that has extended to celebrities as well, for whom using Dr. Bronner's and Instagramming a picture of it is sort of like, it's an image cultivation. It's virtue signaling in a way. So, you know, like Bobby Brown, she has a $1 billion cosmetics brand, but she said on Oprah and in interviews that her favorite personal care product is Dr. Bronner's soap. Drake at one point in time included Dr. Bronner's on his tour rider, along with other items like booze and rolling papers. Olivia Wilde, Jason Mraz, Zoe Kravitz, Natalie Portman. It's really just kind of a who's who of Hollywood and the celebrity world at large that has, you know, said how much they love this soap, this company, and none of them has been paid to do this promotion. This is all voluntarily, you know, them saying, I support what this company does. I support their product. And I want to show that I am on the side of the good guys, which in this case is Dr. Bronner's.
According to you, Sandra Bullock washes her windows with it too. And that leads us to another interesting point. I actually have to pull my glasses down because the font on this label is so tiny. But but one of the things that Dr. Bronner's has done in an era where most companies have figured out that they can make more money if they specialize a lot of things. In other words, if they sell you 8 different kinds of things for very specific uses, you might have to buy all of them. And Dr. Bronner's has always gone in the opposite direction. They think the same thing, this bottle I'm holding in my hand is good to wash your hands with, good for laundry, good to mop the floor, wash the dog, remove residue from fruits and vegetables, just an all-purpose cleaner, doesn't mention anything about Sandra Bullock and her windows, but shave face and your underarms and your legs. And I mean, there's sort of this sense anyway that, yeah, you buy one big 32-ounce bottle and you're not going to run around buying 18 other different kinds of cleaners, which seems very counter to the consumer culture we've had for, I don't know, about 40 years.
Yeah, I mean, they talk about having 18 uses for the Dr. Bronner's soap, and I have personally used Dr. Bronner's for maybe about 15 of those purposes. I think the one thing that people don't seem to be a fan of using Dr. Bronner's for is on their hair, perhaps because it's a little too astringent or has like a high pH value or something. They have a good product, and it's obviously been working for them for 75 years, and it's only in the past few years that they've actually come out with other products. You know, they recently released an organic magic balm and a toothpaste. But again, these products have all natural, pronounceable ingredients, and even though their product line has slightly grown bigger than their original big bottle of soap, the branding and the ethos has just completely remained the same.
The two things that I would say, first of all, when I brought this home, one of the things that was in my mind was, in fact, to use this on the dog, and the other person in the house is not a Bronnerist. And felt that this would be upsetting for the dog. And the other thing is, and I, this is not an omission from your article, but perhaps an exercise of good taste, but young people, the first time that they use the peppermint soap in particular, are often maybe a little unpleasantly surprised with the intensity. Let me just say, you shouldn't squirt this stuff on your junk. It's going to be really upsetting. So there's like, you really do have to dilute it a lot for some of the uses that you can use it for. It might be worth mentioning, you've already talked about this a little bit, but this is also kind of the company we keep saying that we want. Even the CEOs, these family member CEOs, they're not getting crazy salaries. And really, a lot of the money is making it back into the nonprofit sector. I don't know if you wanted to say anything more about that.
Yeah, so I think really the company is just a model of a kind of a modern workplace, modern company that is equitable at all levels of its company. So their activism has implications for both people and the environment. They're supporters of the Green New Deal, they're a certified B Corporation. But especially internally with the company, their healthcare is fully covered for employees. In a country where the median CEO to worker pay is something like 300-1, David and Michael Bronner make roughly $200,000 a year, and they've capped their salaries at 5 times that of the lowest paid workers, who make a minimum wage of over $19, which is 60% higher than the California minimum wage. And from a diversity standpoint, people of color comprise 60% of their employees, and 40% of managers, and you know, women are half their workforce and over half of their managers. And so, you know, these are all numbers that I think the greater corporate world, you hope, would aspire to, you know, given just the rampant inequality between, you know, CEOs and the people they employ.
One last thing that I wanted to mention, which I hadn't known until I read your article, and it amused me greatly, is that now Dr. Bronner speak, we might say, has become kind of a metaphor for incoherent writing that uses a lot of capital letters in weird places, strange punctuation, doesn't really cohere or hang together. Can you think of any prominent national figure who tweets things in that manner? Well, you probably can use your imagination. And so it's very typical.
A guy named Donald Trump, I think, is who you might be referring to. And on Twitter, whenever Trump tweets, as he does so often, as we know, people often pillory him for sounding like a broken racist Dr. Bronner's label, which I think is just telling of how much Dr. Bronner's has saturated the culture, that people are applying this soap label to the diction of the president of the United States. And also, you know, doesn't really say much good about how the president talks.
No. So, Kieran Dahl, however, you talk well, and you are a good radio guest, so stay in touch with us. Freelance writer, his piece for Vox. We love Vox today. We love Vox every day. How a decades-old hippie soap brand became a touchstone of wellness culture. We're going to take a break and come back with our final guest of the day. That's me. I'm going to be the guest. I'm just going to chat with you a little bit more about soap. There were like a whole bunch of things we found out about soap, but we couldn't find one single guest who would say them all.
You know what your son just said?
No, what?
I'll tell you what he said. Ready?
Help me!
Over the years, I got to be quite a connoisseur of soap. My personal preference is for Lux, but I found Palmolive had a nice piquant after-dinner flavor. Heady, but with just a touch of mellow smoothness. Lifebuoy, on the other hand...
You ready to tell me? All right. Where did you hear that word?
Now, I had heard that word at least 10 times a day from my old man. My father worked in profanity the way other artists might work in oils or clay. It was his true medium, a master. But I chickened out, and I blurted out the first name that came to mind.
Schwartz! Oh, I see.
All right, so that's that old tradition. That was a Christmas story, you know that, right? And that's that old tradition of washing somebody's mouth out with soap because they said bad words, which doesn't really make any sense when you think about it. All right, so we got a little bit of time left, but first I have to thank a whole bunch of people, especially Kat Pastor, Supreme Being. Go watch Fifth Element so you'll understand what the Supreme Being is. And we also have to thank Jonathan McNichol, who's the episode producer today. Behind the scenes, it's Katie Tularski, and it's Gina Matruda, and it's Tim Rasmussen, and it's Joe Koss. It's all kinds of people who are working to get us through this very challenging time. Tomorrow, we're going to do The Nose. We've been watching The Tiger King on Netflix. I watched Onward last night, which is a Disney animated elf movie, but you know, not without some intelligence and some sweetness to it. Anyway, if you've got kids, you probably already watched it because you can buy it instead of waiting for it to come to the movie theaters, which, you know, obviously are kind of a problem right now. And yes, we should say that our nighttime rebroadcast has been moved to 10 p.m. If you want to tell somebody else to listen to this show about soap, obviously it'll be available online and in podcast form and all that kind of stuff. But meanwhile, we're doing National Conversations with All Things Considered, a live hour on coronavirus at 9 p.m. Well, I have some things to say about soap, and Kat says I only have 5 minutes. Well, I'll say some things anyway. there's some questions about when and how soap would have been invented. We're going to give it to Mesopotamia today for the purposes of our discussion, because you can never go wrong giving it to Mesopotamia around 2800 BC. But the truth is, it was probably invented over and over again. There's just nobody knew enough to say, hey, this is soap. We just made soap. So, but the way it would have been invented is explained by a chemist from Cambridge University, John Elmsley, who says, you can see how someone was cooking something on a wood fire, and it had fat in it, and it boiled over, and the fat dropped into the wood ash. And then the following morning, when they went to clean up the mess, they would find that when they put water on it, it would lather, and it would clean very well. And it was just a simple type of soap. So, yeah, the wood ash would have the lye, and obviously you need the fat from the fatty thing that you were cooking on the fire. And probably soap was invented over and over again. But the ancients didn't really wash up the way we wash up with soap. And they tended to use soap for other things. They used it to do things like clean wool so that it could be used as a textile, or to treat skin disorders. But, you know, from Mesopotamia on into ancient Greece and ancient Rome, they weren't like washing their hands with soap, despite the strong urging of the Roman senator Antonius Faucius. That's not actually real, obviously. But there was a soap-making factory discovered in the ruins of Pompeii. And so, yeah, the Romans, they tended to use soap to rinse their clothes. They found, because everything goes better with urine, they discovered that it worked better when you mixed it with urine in the city of Florence. The emperor urged the townspeople to kind of pitch in, as it were, so there were big pots. Well, here's John Elmsley again. There were great pots at the street corners where people could add their own contributions to this. The urine was left for several weeks until it actually decomposed and gave it ammonia. And ammonia is a very good cleaning agent and will remove grease and dirt from fabrics. So the prominent Greek physician Galen also talked about soap. But here's the thing. The Romans weren't really using soap that way. They would get soap from the Gauls and the Germans, but they preferred to wash their hands with, put a little oil on their hands and maybe a little sand for abrasion, and then scrape them off. So that was like how they, anyway, when the Roman Empire fell, so did soap, basically. And you know, like, if you think of the people in the Middle Ages as kind of dirty, I think they probably were actually. It took a long time before soap production restarted. Although it did happen a little bit in the Middle Ages, there's some evidence in Marseille and then Genoa and then Venice that it was going on. But soap was a pretty weird thing. People didn't know about it. And it was so little used that in Central Europe, a box of soap was presented to the Duchess of Jülich, I don't know how you say that, in 1549, and it caused a sensation as late as 1672 when a German A. Leo sent Lady von Schleinitz a parcel containing soap in Italy. He had to accompany it with a description of how you would actually use such a thing. The Crusaders discovered it in the 11th century, coming back through Moorish Spain. In World War I, when there were shortages, they started making soap out of bile, out of the bile of animals. And you can still buy to this day soap that is described as bile soap or gall soap. And yes, that is coming, you know, from slaughtered animals and being used as a cleaning agent. Why you would particularly want that thing, I don't know. Use some Dr. Bronner's instead. I don't think he uses any bile at all. All right, we have to stop there. I can't give you any more soap facts, although I have many soap facts, but perhaps for another day. Once again, thanks to all the people who helped make this show what it is. And, oh, they were all going ooh on Slack. I don't even know which thing they were oohing about. Oh, but it's probably the urine part. All right, so we'll be back tomorrow with the nose. So come play with us.